suffered as a result of these events?
Biggest thing is I consider myself a family man and I love my country. And I don't think any one man is bigger than either one of those. I think that's what needs to be taken. You know, people dive into the politics, and for me, I felt like I had, you know, like horse blinders on. I was locked in the whole time. Biggest thing for me is take the blinders off, make sure you step back and see what's going on before it's too late.
Former Trump supporter Stephen Ayers and former Oath Keepers spokesperson Jason Van Tatenhoff, questioned by Congressmember Jamie Raskin. And this is Vice Chair Liz Cheney in her closing remarks.
You will hear that Donald Trump never picked up the phone that day to order his administration to help. This is not ambiguous. He did not call the military. His Secretary of Defense received no order. He did not call his Attorney General. He did not talk to the Department of Homeland Security. Mike Pence did all of those things. Donald Trump did not. We will walk through the events of January 6th next week, minute by minute. And one more item. After our last hearing, President Trump tried to call a witness in our investigation, a witness you have not yet seen in these hearings. That person declined to answer or respond to President Trump's call and instead alerted their lawyer to the call. Their lawyer alerted us. And this committee has supplied that information to the Department of Justice. Let me say one more time, we will take any effort to influence witness testimony very seriously.
Republican Congressmember Liz Cheney, Vice Chair of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. The next public hearing is next week, Thursday, July 21st. Democracy Now! Will live stream it at democracynow.org, as we have all the public hearings, and you can go to all of them at democracynow.org. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Karl Marxer. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, and Noreen Sheikh Maria Torres. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
You're listening. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to sound like a broken record, but you are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. Listen sponsored. Now, become a member now. Become a member not only because everything you hear is straight, everything you hear is the late. Everything here is great. But we also want you to become a member because we want you to get in there and put your shoulders next to the wall like we're doing. Help pay some of them electric bills, some of our toilet papers, our napkins, our portable plates, portable knives and forks. But better than that, even for the staff, the guys are working hard here at KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your dial. And this is Screaming Jay Hawkins telling you why you got to do it. You got to do it not because it's an order, not because it's mandatory, not because it's a must, but it's because this is the only place where you're hearing the right stuff. You're hearing the truth, you're hearing the good sound, and you're digging people who knows what it's all about. So pick up on a few things and lay down some of them other things and just dig KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your dial. And remember, I said so. I, Screaming Jay Hawkins. I ain't walking, I'm talking. I'm squawking. Become a member now. Become a member of KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your dial. I'm about to sign off. Bye. 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 Bye.
We want abortion. Bring it on demand.
Hi, my name is Clara Shotto, and welcome to Rome the Rocks, a podcast that takes a look into the barriers of abortion access here in Oregon and Idaho. In my last episode, I spoke with Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon, the Women X Campaign School, and local OBGYN, Dr. Jennifer Lincoln, about these barriers for many Eastern and rural Oregonians. Today, I'm speaking with Tess Wallace and Sam Katana, Idahoans who were board members of the Northwest Abortion Access Fund. an organization that funds abortions for those in need in Idaho, Oregon, Washington, and Alaska. Both Tess and Sam describe the impact of Idaho's trigger law for both Idaho residents and Oregonians. Before we get into my interview with both Tess Wallace and Sam Katana, here's a little background as I discussed in the first episode. So to begin with, while abortion is legal and unrestricted here in Oregon, it is not accessible for all Oregonians, especially for rural and eastern Oregonians who live upwards of 4 hours away from a clinic that provides abortion services. For these individuals, it is far closer to drive to Idaho than several hours to the nearest clinic in Oregon. But there's a catch. Currently, Idaho requires anyone seeking abortion healthcare to wait 24 hours before receiving access, and mandates that all clinics provide informed consent. So that includes offering an image of the pregnancy and a pamphlet that describes fetal development and the risks associated with an abortion procedure. So those are the current barriers for many Oregonians and all Idaho residents. And on top of this, Idaho is one of 12 trigger law states. These are states that have passed laws, like in Texas, to ban all or most abortions. In Idaho, if Roe is overturned, abortion will be restricted to 6 weeks, with exceptions for those whose life is in danger and individuals who have experienced rape and incest. According to reports, if Roe is overturned, the impact will be so widespread just here in Oregon that there will be a 234% increase in out-of-state patients seeking access to abortion services here in Oregon. And eastern Oregonians could see up to a 35% decrease in abortion access because of the longer travel burden to get to these clinics. Before we continue, I want to mention that this episode discusses rape, incest, sexual violence, and includes detailed explanations of abortion methods. With all of that said, here is my conversation with Tess Wallace with the Northwest Abortion Access Fund.
I am a board director at the Northwest Abortion Access Fund, and we serve Idaho, Oregon, Washington, and Alaska. And we cover the cost of people's abortions by sending funding directly to the clinic. And we also provide travel and logistical support because people are navigating minimal clinic options, a lack of resources, and restrictive state laws when it comes to abortion access. And for the most part, I do this work because it affects me and my community. There's a terrible lack of healthcare across our country, and especially here in Idaho. My background is in voter outreach. I started knocking doors for Medicaid expansion in 2018, and then I found the best way to help is to actually cover costs. Abortions typically cost $650, which is more than most people can afford. Abortion is healthcare, and everyone should have access to it no matter where they live.
All right, so today in this podcast that it's starting out focusing on how's Oregon going to look? This is my home state, and most people have this perception that, you know, Oregon is this liberal utopia that kind of exists on its own regardless of what happens throughout the rest of the country. And I think that's a common conception or perception of other states as well, especially those that are not in the South. And something that I've encountered through my discussions with other people is that, again, no matter what happens to Roe, that Oregon won't be impacted. But something that people aren't necessarily talking about, at least not from what I'm aware of, is that there is a trigger law state that is our neighbor, which is where you reside and work for in a chapter of NWAAF in Idaho. So I'm curious, can you tell me about how Roe being overturned will not only impact where you are, but impact the states around you, like those who are in Oregon, like myself?
Yeah, definitely. While it's true that Oregonians are in a much better position than a lot of other states if Roe falls, everyone in the country will be affected by an outlaw of abortion. To start, it's important to remember that for people in eastern Oregon, the closest clinic is Boise. And without access in Idaho, suddenly that 1 to 2 hour trip becomes a 4 to 5 hour trip. And then you have to consider how many more people will need to travel to Oregon from out of state to receive care. Folks in Idaho, Nevada, even farther, will need to get their abortions in Oregon. which can affect clinic capacity. And if appointments get booked out, that can push back the date of when folks are able to get their abortion, and that increases the cost. So it definitely affects all of us.
And then obviously that's something that your organization tried to mitigate, all of the different ways in which someone might have barriers, obviously, of course, financial barriers. So, you know, cost of the abortion procedure, our medicine, whatever it ends up being that's best for that person. But of course, travel, if someone will need to stay overnight or multiple nights, you know, food.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the other barriers, of course, if that person already has children and needing childcare services. Can you talk about, of course, maintaining confidentiality, of course, but can you talk about some situations in which clients that you have served, specifically in Idaho, and reached out to your chapter?
Yeah, folks in Idaho have a lot of barriers, and we help. Most of the people we end up funding are Idahoans because they have very few options. And we will cover cost of childcare, like you said, or travel or overnight stays. In Idaho, there's a 24-hour waiting period. So people are required to prepare, or people are required to see pictures of fetal development and descriptions of the risks of abortion, and then wait 24 hours to actually receive their abortion. And so if they are traveling, as many Idahoans are traveling from outside of Boise into the Treasure Valley to receive their care, they might need an overnight stay. And so already we're seeing a lot of challenges for people to get their abortions.
I've only been in Idaho a few times. And from what it sounds like, what you're telling me is that with other organizations that I've interviewed, they're helping folks, say like in Texas, go to neighboring states such as Oklahoma, and they need to have overnight stays, all the things that you just described, childcare,
mm-hmm.
cost of the procedure, and so on. What it sounds like you're saying, though, in Idaho, and correct me if I'm getting this wrong, that access is so spread out, and then in addition to the informed consent, the waiting periods, and so on, that's creating a similar process for folks within their home state. Am I getting that right?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's already the case here in Idaho. There are only 3 clinics that provide abortions in Idaho. All of them are in southern Idaho. So anyone who's in central or northern Idaho is going to be crossing state lines to get their abortions. And even if you do decide to get it within the state, you have that 24-hour waiting period. So yeah, we're already dealing with those barriers as it is.
Can you talk about what will Idaho look like if Roe is overturned? Can you talk about the differentiation between what's happening now and how that's going to be very different once Roe is overturned, which many experts believe it will be?
Right. Well, if Roe is overturned, Idaho will not have access to abortion, and so everyone in Idaho who needs an abortion will have to travel out of state. And the good news is the Northwest Abortion Access Fund already has the infrastructure to help folks get their abortions out of state and make sure that those abortions are safe and legal. But it will be much harder, and it will be much more expensive. And we will definitely need a lot more funding to be able to keep that up.
If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Roe on the Rocks on KBOO FM, a podcast about barriers to abortion access here in Oregon and Idaho. I have been speaking with Tess Wallace, a board member of the Northwest Abortion Access Fund, an organization that funds abortions in Oregon, Idaho, Washington, and Alaska. Next, I'm speaking with Sam Katana, also a board member of the Northwest Abortion Access Fund. And she explains that, as an Idaho native, she has doubts that the exceptions written into Idaho's trigger law to allow abortions for those subjected to rape and incest will be enforced given the potential burdensome requirements placed on survivors in order to receive such access. Here's more about this issue with Sam Katana.
Your state has exceptions for a trigger law ban, and in Texas, there's only the exception for the life and the endangerment of the life endangerment of a pregnant person. And I'm wondering, you know, I had a conversation again with someone else who is part of your organization based in Idaho. And there seems to be skepticism about if the trigger law ban is put into effect, about whether or not patients who have been raped or experience incestuous rape, if they'll be able to get, if they'll be eligible as part of that exception within the law. Can you tell me about your perspective? Do you trust that people who are under those circumstances will be able to have access to what will be considered emergency care abortions?
Oh, heavens no.
Okay.
I don't believe that exception. I mean, we know that very rarely do people report violence when it's committed against them for another nuanced conversation of so many reasons of why it's unsafe or not a reasonable expectation for people to report, right? Also just naming that with just the Republican culture in Idaho, I don't know. I was going to say that there is just kind of a not distrust for law enforcement, but I don't know. People are, let me just skip this thought, what I'm thinking. Instead I wanted to, just reiterate that the criminal punishment system doesn't work, and it rarely works for folks who are reporting sexual violence. And so this expectation that people are gonna have access to abortion care after reporting is not legitimate. And I think that there's also some legal gray area around what part of the reporting process someone has to have, you know, made it through in order to get that abortion. So, I mean, even though there is a technical exception in Idaho's law, that's not going to be the case if this trigger ban were to go into effect.
Gotcha. How is your organization responding to the current barriers and the potential barriers regarding abortion access? So can you explain what that looks like in terms of like funding, community involvement? Similar to what you just said with those down in the South.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to continue to keep doing what we're doing, which is meeting the needs of our callers. You know, that's like as simple as I want to put it. And it also is definitely going to mean like spending more money on travel, which in turn means us as a board and as supporters of abortion access, like that means we'll have to fundraise at new levels that we haven't seen before. But I'm also confident, and I have trust that our people are going to just rise up and meet our needs in the same ways that we just meet callers' needs. You know, of course, more mobilizing have to happen across the region, especially in rural places. We want to mobilize everyone who believes in abortion access to contribute where they can, whether it's to give rides or open their homes when they have extra rooms for people to stay in. And of course, that's, you know, when it's safe COVID-wise, but you know, everyone has a stake in this movement, and so making sure people have education, have resources to be able to fundraise. I think we're really just expecting to bring more people into this work. And a lot of, it's hard because a lot of what we do is really just like getting money out the door to people when they need it, and to clinics when they need it. And so, yeah, it's so hard being in like this capitalist system that we're all existing in. Is money is central to what we do, and gosh, that's hard.
Yeah,
you can only ask for money so many times. Like, but it's also like changing the framework of charity versus solidarity, right? Where like all of us need to actively redistribute our wealth to achieve a better world for all of us.
And I know we've talked about this, and I've talked about this in a couple other interviews, and I just kind of want to resurface the current reality of folks who go to Idaho for abortion access, whether that's Eastern Oregonians, rural Oregonians, or those who live in Idaho. And just kind of, you know, clarifying what that looks like. From what I understand, based on my research and going on your organization's website, there are specific requirements, and those can create additional barriers in addition to costs. And I was wondering if you can talk about the waiting period and the informed consent requirements in Idaho.
Yeah. Well, for Idahoans under 18 who are seeking abortion care, having to get that parental consent is a huge barrier for people. People don't always have relationships with their parents or with their guardians that are trusted, and you know, people still need access to that care. And so for them to have to then navigate a legal system where they have to go in front of a judge and get a judicial bypass, that's a really intimidating barrier to care for people who already potentially don't have support from family. In Idaho, we also have an informed consent law, so that means doctors have abortion providers have to give some specific information about quote-unquote risks for abortion care, and we also have a 24-hour waiting period between receiving that information and then the procedure. So that's another barrier to care too. In Idaho, we also have this abortion reversal law. So for folks getting a medication abortion in Idaho, they're required to receive info on, quote, abortion reversal, which is this not science-backed procedure. It really just aims to make people getting an abortion second-guess that decision and add to that kind of shameful narrative that Idaho is choosing to perpetuate in our state literature. So that's really gross. And so that means that Oregon people who are going into Idaho for care also have to experience that, which could be, you know, in Eastern Idaho, there is still a culture of anti-abortion, pro-life, whatever. So maybe seeing this Idaho literature wouldn't challenge those ideas too much. And still, it's an unnerving thing when a physician is giving you really politically biased information like that.
And just to clarify, they're legally required, whether or not they agree with it, they're legally required to do so, correct?
It's exactly a legal requirement, and it has to be the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare approved literature that's given out to abortion patients.
And just to clarify, because I haven't heard of this in other conversations, can you go back and clarify, because I don't quite understand, what does that mean, the language that is it the abortion reversal, is that part of the pamphlets, the information in the pamphlets that are given out? And you said that specifically for abortion medication?
Yes. Yeah. So it is a pamphlet that people are given during that informed consent period. And so part of the medication abortion, the first pill you take strips the body of progesterone. And so this abortion reversal procedure, basically you wouldn't take the second pill of your medication abortion, which is what contracts your uterus and then expels the contents. And so instead of taking that pill, that, you know, is actually what kind of makes the cervix contract, instead of taking that pill, you would inject progesterone back into your body, progesterone being the hormone that you need to facilitate a healthy pregnancy. It's just like they're really experimenting with hormones.
Wow, I've never heard of this, but I'm in my late 20s and I'm embarrassed to say this, but I think it's important to be honest. Before entering this project, I didn't necessarily have a clear understanding of so many things, including what the abortion process is and the various forms, including abortion medication, methylprednisolone. I said that wrong. I'll get that in post. But in a conversation with a local Portland OBGYN doctor here in Portland, Oregon, she mentioned how, you know, like what you were saying, to finish an abortion through abortion medication, it's a two-pill process. Right. And that's very, I've never heard of that, what you just said, that the way that the healthcare system is set up, and it sounds very intentional in Idaho, is to have a process to hopefully discourage, maybe even shame and guilt a person early on into the abortion process, and literally what you're saying is reverse it. And yeah, anyway, I did not know that was a thing that existed.
I mean, it shouldn't be a thing, right? Because the health studies they're like laughable at the small sort of group of people they tried to experiment on, you know. And the disgusting part is it's so predatory the way that they talk about this and are requiring providers to talk about this. And then you leave the clinic and there's a crisis pregnancy center literally right next door. All three of our Planned Parenthood clinics here in Idaho have a Stanton or a different crisis pregnancy center next door, where they have big banners on their building saying abortion reversal here.
Wow.
It's like, it's just the most predatory and confusing thing, right? Because the majority of people don't have access to this knowledge. There is not something challenging this just like overarching narrative and understanding. Yeah.
Next, I spoke with Lois Anderson, the executive director of Oregon Right to Life, to get a pro-life perspective about this issue. And she explains her organization's view on abortion and some of the misconceptions of pro-life advocates. Now, here's my conversation with Lois Anderson. for my understanding, researching the organization, it's not, it's, I don't know if it's apolitical, but it's not necessarily rooted in any specific religion. Is that correct or not?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Gotcha. And then I'd really like to get in, whether I do this during the interview or outside of the interview, I'm going to read the definitions y'all have for various key issues. And I know that your organization stands for other issues such as assisted suicide, but obviously we're focusing on abortion.
Yeah.
I don't mind reading it, but would you mind telling me what Oregon Rights Life mission is and position is, rather, on abortion? I can read it too. I don't mind. I have it open.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So it says that...
I'm getting it.
No worries. It says that Oregon Right to Life believes in the sanctity of all human life and the moment of conception to natural death. Abortion ends the life of genetically distinct growing human being. We oppose abortion at any point of gestation. In rare cases, a mother may have a life-threatening condition in which medical procedures intended to treat the condition of the mother may result in the unintended death of her preborn baby. At the same time, Oregon Right to Life recognizes that in most cases, modern medical practice has and will continue to increase the ability to save both the life of the mother and the baby. So that's what your website states. Is there anything you want to add to that or clarify? And I do have questions about the definition.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, we've worked hard on those statements, and it's so well put for what our overall mission is and our position on abortion.
Got it. But I do have some questions that I didn't get through the definition. Does Oregon Right to Life leave room for exceptions, whether that's just because the way that I'm reading it, it states that a medical procedure might unintentionally kill a preborn child, but it doesn't necessarily state, well, a doctor may choose and need to do that. In